Prepare to be astonished.
It's that time again.
Let's get started.
From the Clatsop County Historical Society, an adventure in history with Matt Burns and Alana Quila.
You should never be allowed to talk to people.
Some people without brains do an awful lot of talking.
And now, with today's adventure, it's Mac and Alana.
Good evening and welcome to the month of May with another adventure in history. And I'm excited about our topic tonight because it's one of my favorite guests.
It's the best guest.
It is the best guest, making this the best show of the year so far.
Best show ever.
Right.
Although, how does this compare to previous visits from you?
Well, I'm feeling a lot more pressure suddenly.
Ooh, just suddenly. That's Dr. Chelsea Vaughn, if you don't recognize her voice, curator for the Clatsop County Historical Society, here to talk about a new exhibit.
Yep, Double Vision. We just opened that.
I love it.
And you are a rock star. We'll talk about that in a minute, but we got to get rid of some business here first. Okay. But this is, I did not go back and count, but you are quickly climbing. If you are not the most frequent visitor, you are getting close.
Who else would be the most frequent?
And you're not, well, we've talked about this. Sam Rasko.
Okay. But I haven't interviewed him ever.
Kevin Leahy.
Okay. And I don't.
Has been a frequent guest. Dulcie Taylor has been a frequent guest. And John Gutenberger.
Okay.
But I suspect.
I think Chelsea is tops
the cake.
I'm getting up there now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I think so.
Good.
So are you still nervous about being here? You're not nervous. You're just goofing around.
No, hopefully not. But yeah. Don't. Yeah.
All right. So do we want to start with the word?
Or I got
start
a word.
Plug in stuff or start with this day in history?
Let's start with the word. I'm ready.
All right.
Mafic. M-A-F-F-I-C-K. And it's a verb.
Mafic.
Mafic.
Is when you are confused by math, is my guess.
Ooh, math.
So now you can be far smarter.
That was actually my first instinct was to go with something math-based, but then that wouldn't make any sense because of the Fs instead of the TH. If you're mafic, you are kind of slowly suffocating.
Ooh.
So, no.
It turns dark.
Yeah, not at all. I mean, it depends how you feel about this, but it's actually to celebrate in an extravagant, rowdy manner, which is how I feel about this exhibit coming up. You can, the exhibit makes you want to have some mafic.
I don't think that one's going to catch on again. Some of the words I like, and I think, hey, maybe.
Verbs are hard to use in a sentence when we don't really understand
the
word, right?
I like how you said, oh, we don't understand. You glared at me as you said that.
I feel like also it's kind of weird as a verb. It makes more sense almost as like an adjective. Like it's a mafic display as opposed to going mafic on this experience. Yeah. I don't know.
Right. Yeah, that doesn't sound good to me.
Yeah, okay.
It does not sound like a positive.
Which is maybe why I guess the exact opposite of what it actually is.
I am mafic about our day off. I'm mafic about our vacation. It just doesn't.
And it's extravagant, rowdy manner. Yeah. So maybe that's not a good thing necessarily, right?
Yeah. The visitors to Andrew Jackson's White House inaugural ball were mafic.
Yep.
Yeah, that's.
That would work. That may be where they first used the word.
There we go. And then stopped.
Right.
All right. So we have things coming up. It's busy season, not only for a bunch of visitors to all of the museums and all of Clatsop County, but the Historical Society has a number of events coming up. And we talked about some of these last week, but I brought the expert in because you did pronounce it correctly, but we did kind of stumble and we had to say it slowly.
Right.
So I'm going to let Chelsea talk about our lecture on May 9th.
Okay, on May 9th, we have another Chelsea Rose. Occasionally, I've worked with her in the past, and it's strange to have another Chelsea in the room. But she's from the Oregon Chinese Diaspora Project out of Southern Oregon. They work throughout the state. She's going to be up here doing research, looking at potential sites in the area of, previous Chinese residency. And as part of that, she's going to be giving a talk at the local public library.
At the flag room in the Astor Public Library.
Right.
At 7 o'clock on May 9th. And we don't know when doors open, probably 6:30-ish.
I'll have the key, so whenever I feel like it.
That's right. So explain that word again, because I think did we describe what that word meant last time? I can't remember.
I don't think we did.
So, diaspora, it's a, sort of a spreading out of people often through force, either famine or warfare or things of that nature. So talking about Chinese immigration in the 19th century, diaspora is a very appropriate word because people really were, again, pushed out by things like famine and warfare. Often the dispersion of people of African descent throughout the world through slavery is referred to as the African diaspora.
Would Native Americans as well?
That's more generally a displacement, I guess. Okay. I think is the word more often applied to Native Americans. But you know, there's the Jewish diaspora. There's several, terrible historical events that create, mass movement of people.
Right. And she's coming to do a little bit of research here.
She is going to do research here, yeah. So our own Lisa Penner in the archive has done great work documenting the experiences of, the Chinese immigrant community locally. And so Chelsea is going to keep becoming and looking at some of that work and, seeing what she might be able to do with it.
So am I hearing that we should have a policy and no more Chelseas?
No, I'm not anti-Chelsea.
Or do we want more Chelseas?
I think I'm comfortable with the level of Chelseas that we have.
All right. Well, we're excited by this. This is going to be a neat one. And normally our lecture series is at Fort George Brewery, but that is not a Thursday night. Tuesday night.
This one is a Thursday night, but it's just not our Thursday night, right? Somebody else already had it.
Yeah, oh, man.
We only have the third Thursday.
Right. We have to.
And this is not the third Thursday.
Yeah.
But speaking of that, we do have our last Thursday night talk on May 16th. Mike Lamey. He's written two books. He's with his wife. He's the owner of Greenwood Cemetery, which I don't like to play favorites, but I really like Greenwood Cemetery a lot.
Yes.
And we've had our Talking Tombstones there three times, I think. And there's some of the best stories and some of the amazing tombstones are in that cemetery. And he's written two really great books. He's been one of our performers at Talking Tombstones. That's how we first met him. And it's going to be really great. He's going to talk at our TNT on May 16th. Prior to that, though, May 11th, the day before Mother's Day, is our Mother's Day tea and scones from 1 to 4. Reservations are requested and required, and it's sponsored by the Stemper family, so thank you. But it's $15 for non-members of the Historical Society and $10 if you're a member. So your membership saves you money.
Or you can just buy your membership at the same time.
You could.
Right.
That's true. Do it all at once. One check.
If you're like
me,
check.
If you're like me and write checks.
Right. I'm rolling my eyes here, folks.
I'm getting lots of eye rolling right now. And then the old-fashioned fun and game sponsored by Columbia Memorial Hospital is May 18th and 19th.
Yay, one of our favorites.
It is. So Chelsea, you have a lot to do with this, and you've helped kind of reinvent some aspects of it. So do you want to talk a little bit about why you love fun and games?
I like fun and games. I like the sort of like Victorian fair component of it, and it's really based upon that. And within that, there can be a lot of different components, and I've tried to maybe make some of those more visible. There's this sort of carnival-esque sideshow components of it, but then there's also the learn how to make butter. And strangely enough, kids really enjoy washing clothes on an old-fashioned washboard. That one always blows me away the first year. We put out like cold water in these tubs, and I thought, okay, maybe. No, hours. Kids will spend hours there. My own kid included. She wouldn't do that at home for a second, but there we are, washing.
At home where laundry's easy.
Right, right. Yeah.
And it's very hands-on, and I would say a pretty wide range of age, too, because usually you have badminton set up, so I see lots of older kids like getting a real game going, and then like the butter making and the laundry churning, those hands-on things that little kids of really any toddling age to do.
That's always one of the dilemmas, because like the pie eating contest, we only have limited seating and limited pies. And a lot of like the 12 and 13 and 14 year olds really want to get in on it. And I always kind of limit it to the youngest kids first. And then invariably one of them will say they want to do it. And then the minute the reality of sticking their head into a, a face into the pie, they don't want to do it. Then the older kid's like, I would have won.
Right.
So
yeah,
the dilemmas that we face as museum professionals.
It's hard. Very challenging.
And then, of course, the Goonies 39th anniversary, June 7th, 8th, and 9th. Lots of things going on. So check our website and listen to the local radio for updates and local media and social media and all that good stuff.
Love it.
So
lots going on.
All right. Shall we get to the This Day in History so you can appear really smart with your friends and neighbors and coworkers? These are things that happen tomorrow, May 6th. And they're not always pleasant. They're just the history highlights. 1826, Dutch colonist Peter Minuit organizes the purchase of Manhattan Island from Native Americans for 60 guilders worth of goods, believed to have been the Counterissi Indians. But I always referred to them as, growing up, I always heard them as the Lenape.
Okay.
So, but we bought Manhattan. So that was almost going to be my history highlight.
That's a pretty big deal.
Yeah. But then I thought, well, we were going to take it anyway.
Right.
One way or the other. Yeah. So I don't know that that had such an impact because they would have stolen it at some point. So 1837, U.S. blacksmith John Deere creates the first steel plow in Grand Detour, Illinois.
John Deere.
That's John Deere.
That seems later than I think the first plow.
1837. That seemed kind of late to me as well.
He's just the trendy one.
Okay. Yeah.
And then I laughed. I thought you could interpret that he made the first one in Illinois. Not the first one ever, just the first one in Illinois. But I thought, why would they give him lots of credit for that?
Right.
That was almost going to be my history highlight too, because I thought, wow.
Yeah.
Because I worked at a living history site in Wichita, Kansas, and we built an 1880 demonstration farm. So I've actually plowed just once, one row, and it was enough for me.
That was it. You're done.
You look at it like in the movies and things, and you think, well, oh, the horse or the oxen or the mule is doing all the work, and how hard is that? It's really hard.
Is it really? I mean, yeah. It looks terrible regardless.
It is not pleasant.
And I'm trying to imagine farming before the plow, so it's even harder.
Oh my gosh. Right. Yeah. Crazy. We salute you, farmers.
Yeah. Thank you.
Good for you, because I don't want to do that work, even if it's all mechanized. 1840, the world's first adhesive postage stamp. It's called the Penny Black. It's first used in Great Britain.
Okay.
Britain's on the job here. 1882. This was also in consideration for the history highlight of the day. 1882, Chinese Exclusion Act. The U.S. Congress ceases Chinese immigration. We've talked about that a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Had a huge impact. 1904, the American Lung Association holds its first meeting.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, I wonder if they smoked at it. 1937, the Hindenburg disaster.
Oh, it was? Really?
Oh, the humanity.
I missed that.
That was my impression.
That's
of
terrible.
Not as many people killed as I would have thought just from knowing about it.
How many?
It's like 37 people out of like 90 some. Oh. One guy on the ground and the rest were passengers.
Okay. I mean, it is so small. The...
It was kind of a slow moving catastrophe too. So I don't know if they have time to get to the back of the ship.
And how do you abandon ship? I mean, I guess there are ropes you could try to roll down.
Maybe the 37 dead.
Yeah. So 1940, John Steinbeck wins the Pulitzer Prize for The Grapes of Wrath.
Saw that. Yep.
As one of the things that you get assigned, at least once when I was young, you got assigned to read.
Mm-hmm.
I actually really like The Grapes of Wrath. I think it's a really good book, actually. Comments? Discuss?
Yeah.
No opinions.
I mean, he's a good writer. I haven't read it recently, but I mean, yeah, it's dated. It's definitely been replicated, though, because okay. I think it's like The Great Transition is one from maybe last year or this year that said it's the new Grapes of Wrath.
Okay. Oh. It's become a standard bearer. People are like,
right.
Is this the modern day Grapes of Wrath?
It is.
Yeah.
Interesting. So maybe it's just because I love that time period.
Mm-hmm.
I love the between the World War I and World War II.
Yeah.
I do. I really, I mean, I like westward expansion, but there's a lot of ugliness with that, of course. So, but I like that time period between the two World Wars.
Yeah.
All right. 1957, the last broadcast of I Love Lucy on CBS. Do we care?
I do. Yes, of course I love Lucy.
See, I don't love Lucy.
Oh, no? She was great.
Yeah.
I'm going to become hated on the radio here. On that same day in 1957, Pulitzer Prize is awarded to John F. Kennedy for Profiles in Courage. How do we feel about that? Because he didn't really write it.
No, yeah.
But he got the Pulitzer Prize. Well, yeah. The thought behind it?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
I have heavy opinions that I've shared before about this, so we'll move on.
Okay.
1994, the English Channel Tunnel opens. 2004, the final episode of Friends airs. Do we care?
So it was on mine. Oh, Chelsea said nope.
I don't, but I might be in the minority there.
Completely watched it live, cried, loved it.
Didn't age well.
It did not. I know it has not aged well.
I mean, yes. There's a lot of things I will not say. No, we cannot put our current values onto that. But it didn't age well.
Right. Yeah. Six white friends in New York City. Yep.
And the huge apartment. Please, come on. I've been to New York. Okay. But our history highlights, I think had the most impact. And we had a variation of this just a couple of weeks ago. But 1935, FDR creates the Works Progress Administration, the WPA. I love the WPA.
I knew you were going to pick that one. I saw that.
And it's not just that I like FDR.
And the Great Depression.
Right.
And
the Great Depression. Because FDR is not number one or number two. He's in the top, usually the top five for me, but definitely the top 10. But the WPA, I mean, post office murals and oral histories and tons of other things. So I think it had the most impact on history.
Yeah.
And preserving history.
Preserving it. Yep.
So what did I miss? Anything?
No, you didn't. That's pretty good. I had friends on my list because I didn't think you were going to pick that one. I was like, no way will Mac do this.
I kind of thought that, I back in my mind, I kind of thought she liked that show.
Yeah, I did.
I couldn't remember.
Although barely, you know, it's 20 years. It's not 25. So, you know, is it history yet? Not quite, but.
So, you know, we made fun of, is Chelsea nervous about being here? But I actually get more nervous when she's here for myself of I'm going to sound really stupid when I talk about like this day in history or something like that. And this is the wonderful thing about being a museum director is you get to work with people that are far smarter, far more capable than you. And when people ask me something and I don't know it, and they're like, what do you mean you don't know it? I say, I don't need to know it. I have an archivist. I have a curator. I have all this great staff that surrounds me. So it's a good thing.
It is.
But still, like when I'm talking about things, I'm like she's sitting there judging me.
Like when you say the Friends last episode and she's...
Yeah.
She's like, this is not history.
This is not what I signed up for. Okay, but before we let you talk about this exhibit, I have said this repeatedly, and I will shout it on the mountaintops or anyone who will listen. And right now, since we have loyal listeners listening, you and Matt Powers, our facilities manager, he's an ace carpenter and creative genius, and other staff that get involved, volunteers that you recruit, you knock out exhibits on a very small budget in a relatively small space like anybody. I would put you up against the Smithsonian or any other museum in the world. Oh. You guys do amazing work, and you are creative, and you make the Heritage Museum and all of our museums look so good. So talk about this new exhibit, because this is three in a row that have just been amazing.
And one more introduction, just in case you missed it, folks, but it is Dr. Chelsea Vaughn, in case that glowing review didn't spark your memory. But yeah, she's amazing, and she's here.
First of all, thank you. That's very kind. I've been very excited about this most recent exhibit, and it is called Double Vision, the Art and Science of Optical Illusion in Clatsop County. It's well based on, as the name hopefully implies, you know, our optical illusion as it applies to our local area. It came about, I was looking through old files of things that we've done in the past. I have an amazingly modern system of a file cabinet and lots of scrawled notes in manila folders in my office of things we've done in the past. Some of them have dates on them, some do not. But back sometime in the 90s, we did an exhibit on stereographic viewing cards, which, if people are not familiar, those are, you know, they're from the Victorian era. If you go to the Flavelle House, you'll see we have a few on display where you look through them and there's a little card with the same image twice, or almost the same image twice. It is slightly different. And that creates, looking through that, it creates a 3D effect. So starting to look into that and what that could be, you know, to build a new exhibit. And when I say I pull old exhibits, I never recreate them like they were. I use them as a starting point, generally, even if I intend to just do them as they were. But based upon that, you know, I found that actually Astoria and the North Coast was a very popular subject for such cards. So that was one way to look at it. You know, it was for tourism, it was for education.
These are the cards that are those round
things. That's a zoetrope.
Okay.
So I should say in this exhibit, before I start talking about the nitty gritty details, we actually have quite a few actual things on display that you can look through, you can spin, you can see like early forms of animation. And, you know, back to what Mac was saying about our facilities manager, Matt, he built most of those. Like, for, I have to give him full credit for all the times he'd come into work. I'm like, hey, I found this 1830s sketch. You could build this, right? Here's an example of the first ever stereographic viewer. You can build this, huh? And he did. So I say good job to that. And it's very impressive. And it's a lot of fun because these things are then also very interactive. Like the zoetrope, you spin and you see, you know, moving images. We also have another one, it's a praxioscope, which is the same concept but uses mirrors and just all of these things. And it's very fun.
I think that one's kind of my favorite because I think people, even if they don't know the word zoetrope, they know what it is when they see it.
Right.
They're like, oh yeah, a little horse trotting or the
right.
or somebody running. But the mirror one is really cool and I've never seen that before.
But I hadn't either, actually. It was until I started researching this and that was, you know, somebody, it was a French science teacher. He was frustrated with how the fact with, because with a zoetrope, to get the image, to get the illusion of movement, you have to look through little slots in the side of the wheel. And he felt like that was too much. So he introduced mirrors to reflect the image back. So to make it easier viewing, but also to make it so that in theory, more people could be looking at it at once. And yeah, that one's a fun one because it is A, easier to see and B, just a different way of seeing how that sort of pre-animation technology works.
But you also have some 3D photos.
We do, too. Yes. So actually, that was one of the great things with this exhibit is we had some collaboration with a few artists who have done work locally. So Dean Walsh, he, back in 2006, made a series of 3D photographic images, and they were on display locally. And he, very fortunately for us, he donated one of those to our museum. So that's how I was able to even know this existed. And hunt him down, and he then loaned us his images.
Oh,
and so
they're beautiful.
They're great. Yeah, they're great. And we have the 3D glasses. If people are not familiar with these, they're the traditional, like, one red, one blue lens, and you look at the image and suddenly it seems like it's popping out to you. And yeah,
I mean, there's so much. I think that anyone that's interested in photography is just going to be amazed at the detail that you have in this exhibit. And then the hands-on stuff will keep the kids going, right, while you're reading all of about the history here. I mean, because I felt like you just had tons of levels, right? Like the levels for my little kids and then levels for me to look up and down. And those 3D photos, I mean, when we were standing back from them, they're beautiful as they are, right? I mean, then it was Mac that pointed out to me, oh, those are 3D. And yes, they do.
Put the little glasses on.
Right. They're really right. Stunning.
Right.
Yeah, I like the fact, and I didn't realize this until the exhibit, that where was the ViewMaster invented?
So the ViewMaster is actually invented in Portland, and it's funny because I grew up in the area, so when I was a kid, the ViewMaster factory was next to Washington Square in Tigard. So
and
I
you
never,
knew about it? You did you know?
It was there. It was a giant building that said ViewMaster on the side. Yeah, when I was younger, I had a friend who did an art project and was actually sponsored by ViewMaster, and so she had like everyone pull out their ViewMasters in the audience at a particular time. And yeah, it was a local business. It was probably not something I thought too much about, honestly, because I was a kid and it was just here. And but so that's a fun thing because that then ties in again to the history of the area. The first ViewMaster reels weren't actually in the North Coast, but they were in Oregon. And then I was able to locate a series of reels, you know, of the North Coast, of Astoria specifically. It features our salmon industry, which, and it's actually a little bit weirder than that because it's just like a few people hanging out on a dock holding up giant salmon. And that's us.
And that's the history of fishing in Astoria.
That's all of Astoria right there.
And what I'm curious about, because obviously ViewMasters go way back, but from my childhood, you know, you would have ones if you went to Disney, you could buy one. If you visit the Grand Canyon, the visitor center would sell them.
Right.
And when I picture, like, okay, they had pictures of Astoria and salmon and maybe Haystack Rock and Cannon Beach, I think, where did those all go? Where did people, I mean, was somebody in London, England looking at this ViewMaster of Astoria? You know, how far out did they go? Because the ones from my childhood were mass produced and kind of everywhere.
Right. Yeah, that's interesting. Well, that's certainly, you know, I had the ViewMaster of Astoria was that one seems a little bit rare. I had to hunt that one down. Whereas, say, other things, like I think in our collection, mysteriously, we have something like 20 different ones of like the Oregon Caves or something like that. But it's the same one over and over. One thing I found, though, is like going back to the stereographic images, which are sort of the precursor to ViewMaster, a lot of those I actually found in the collections of the Library of Congress. And I also found in the collections of the California Museum of Photography. So certainly these things had a reach.
So when you talk about that, then do you reach out to those collections? I mean, how does this, when you say, I hunted them down.
Well, so the great thing actually is through the magic of digitization, I've actually, like Library of Congress, that's a good place just to start looking in general. And the California Museum of Photography, I'd actually worked with as a graduate student. So I was familiar with their collections already and need to start there, but it was all digital, so I was able to actually find those things online and access them that way.
And then are they free, or is it because you're a museum, you have rights to them? How does that work?
Different museums have different setups and agreements, but increasingly, one thing I've enjoyed about the information age is people are moving away from trying to keep everything like sacred into themselves and have started becoming more open about sharing and making, you know, increasing access and making technology or knowledge more available.
I think most of the time, organizations like us just want credit that it's in our collection, that it came from our collection, or within our collection, that it was the John Smith photographic collection that was given to us, that kind of thing. It's just the recognition, not the actual, you can't use that image, it belongs to us.
Right. You know, I get contacted semi-regularly for people wanting to use images from our collection. That really is the thing more than anything else. It's not the, you know, $5 we're going to charge you, but it's the acknowledgement that it came from us.
No, unless like Hollywood wants to use it in a movie, and then we might make some money on
it. Yes, that's a different animal. Yeah.
But if it's just you want to put it on your wall in your museum, or if you want to put it in your newsletter or something like that, then we're always cooperative, and hopefully other organizations are cooperative.
Yeah. When you started looking at the stories, like the stories on the photography that's on the wall just when you walk in, so how do you start the research like that? Like, where do you just start? Did you start within your own archives for that information?
Are you talking about the local photographers? Mm-hmm. So local photographers, that was, you know, again, I very much benefit from people who have done research in the past. So we already, you know, years of having to figure out like our own photo collection means that we actually have extensive research on local photographers. So I was able to sort of pull from that and pull photos from our collection of local photographers, which was great to use and reproduce.
So talk to us a little bit about Dr. Rohn.
Oh yeah, shoot, I didn't get to him at all. So that was the other component of this. He was an optometrist. He was 94 years old in the 1990s and still trying to apply for U.S. patents. He used optical illusions as a way of creating eye exercises. He like patented a lot of things, a lot of moving images, a lot of dual imagery, things of that nature. He claims credit for the Portland, I think it's the Beavers baseball team. I'm probably getting that part wrong. Their winning season by having them do eye exercises to increase their vision. He's a character in and of himself. I wish I talked about him more, but he's definitely one to come and check out and learn more about.
And he's from here.
Yes, he was active in Astoria. So his business starts in 1919. Like I said,
oh my goodness,
he's in the 1990s. He's still actively trying to get new things for eyes.
And he's not just a kook. I mean, he's really doing these things.
He's a doctor.
He's making advancements.
He's not just a mad scientist type. But he's someone who's very invested in, eye strengthening exercises.
Yeah, eye health.
Exactly.
I love it. How long is this exhibit going to be here, just in case we want to come check it out?
It should be up to the end of the year.
Awesome.
Yeah. And we should say that it's sponsored by James and Janet Ahlberg, and they've sponsored a number of things for us because they love the work that Chelsea and the team does.
Yeah, that's great.
All right, some history. Thank you very much, and come in and see this exhibit because it's really good and you will enjoy it whether you're 9 or 90. If you're 92, you may not enjoy it. No, you will. Go make some history. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you next week.
Thank you for joining us for An Adventure in History. An Adventure in History is created and produced by the Clatsop County Historical Society and brought to you by KMUN.